Welcome everyone. We're just going to get started here. Hope the volume is okay. Just going to first we'll do the opening homage, paying respect to the Buddha. The Sangha, that's up at the top. Today we'll continue our study of the Satipatthana Sutta. First, the pay respect. Arahang Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivadi Swagato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammam namasami. Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sangham namami. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Okay. So this is the second session where we'll be studying the Satipatthana Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. And so if you scroll down in the document, you'll see a marker that says we are here. And indeed, that's where we are, where we left off last week. So we're actually still in the introduction, but we're getting into the main content of the sutta now. We're actually going to talk about what the sutta is about. And this is explaining these four foundations of mindfulness, the four satipatthana. And in doing so, he explains not only the four satipatthana, but also makes it quite clear what the four satipatthana are for. They're not an intellectual exercise. Four satipatthana are not theory. You could think of them as a theoretical teaching, but The Buddha goes straight to the heart and reminds us that not only of what the four foundations are, but how one practices the four foundations. And I think this really goes with this idea that the Buddha's teaching is not only practical, but the Buddha's teaching is that reality is based on practice. So when we talk about the four foundations of mindfulness, we're actually talking about a type of practice, intrinsically. We're not talking about something theoretical for us to think about. So kaya nupasana, or kaya satipatthana, the foundation of mindfulness that is body, is a practice, and mindfulness of feelings is a practice. Because the word satipatthana, it's actually not quite clear what the word means, but I think there's a fair agreement nowadays that it should be upatthana, which means the establishing. It's kind of a a verb, to set up. So foundation is actually probably not the correct translation. If we translate it as satipatthana, then we have a thing, no? The body as a foundation of mindfulness. But it seems pretty clear that the actual breaking up of the compound satipatthana is into the word sati and upatthana. And when you add the u, it means it is no longer referring to referring to that thing as the body as being a patana. It's referring to the action, upatana, the action of setting up mindfulness on the body. So you would explain the compound differently. Instead of the foundation of mindfulness, it's the setting up mindfulness, establishing mindfulness, bringing about mindfulness in regards to the body. So again, let's make this a meditative teaching for ourselves as well. Now we can start with the body. If you already know about different ways to be mindful of the body, you can start with those. If not, then we're going to go through a whole bunch here. So this paragraph is really the synopsis of the whole rest of the sutta. Here he's expanding the expanding the meaning of Chattaro Satipatthana, the four establishings of mindfulness. But then he's going to expand this paragraph even further as we go on. So first we have this word bhikkhu again. And I mentioned last time that I even made a note, I think. What a bhikkhu means, bhikkhu is bhayang, sangsare bhayang ikati, when he sees the danger in samsara. But the commentary gives a bit more of a nuanced explanation of this word, saying that you can still understand that the Buddha is talking about a monk. And with the word bhikkhu, he doesn't necessarily mean everyone. He could be referring to a monk. But what it means by that is that because the monk's life, or the life of a monk, or the status of a monk is considered to be the highest, then we can consider that all lay people are also included in there. It's just the highest example. In the commentary, I think, says something about when you talk about the king, when you talk about the royalty or something like that, you're referring to also their whole... I say the king is coming, but you know actually it's not only the king coming, it's many, many, many people who are not the king. So the commentary explains that it can be like that, the bhikkhu is just an example. But the commentary acknowledges that it can also be true that, as the Buddha has said many times, or another way of understanding this is that the commentary twists it around and says the Buddha here could be saying that someone is considered a bhikkhu because they practice satipatthana. Meaning someone is considered a bhikkhu because they live contemplating the body and the body and so on. Or it's saying how a bhikkhu should live, how one should live in order to be considered a bhikkhu. Because as I said, there are two kinds of bhikkhu. There's the sutta bhikkhu and the vinaya bhikkhu. The vinaya bhikkhu is only a monk. The sutta bhikkhu is anyone who... in this case, anyone who practices satipatthana. So right away we get some important, some words that are important to explain and some phrases that are important to explain. And the first one that we get is this seemingly strange phrase, Kaya Kaya Nupasi. He lives contemplating the body in the body. And it's this passage, I think, that has given a certain group in Thailand their idea that there are bodies within bodies. That within our body we have another body, and within that body there's another body. Very famous, well, it's an offshoot of a very famous group. And it got to the point where even very, very famous monks are explaining it in this way. They say, in the middle of our human body, we have another body, and this is the angel body, in the very center. And in the very center of that body, there is the God body. And in the center of that body, there is the Dhamma body. And anyway, it's much more detailed than that, I think. But there's even a book I read about this, and he said, in the middle of the middle of the middle of that body, there's another body. And in the middle of the middle of the middle of the middle of that body, and so on. He just went on and on about this. And he said, this is the middle way. This is the way of the middle or something. Which I think we can toss out the window based on our study of the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. This was a monk who studied Pali to the ninth level, the highest level in Thailand, and still doesn't seem to know what the middle way is. He thinks it's in the middle of his body. So then what does this mean? If it doesn't mean that we have bodies inside of bodies. In Pali, it's actually a lot easier to understand. It's you know, a bit idiomatic, but if you know a little bit about Pali, it doesn't sound as strange as in the English, because they do say things like this. They'll say, I'm trying to think of an example, but sometimes with the use of a verb, for example, you repeat the verb, or you repeat the root of the verb, which in English sounds really weird, but so you say you hear something that is hearable or something like that. I can't think of a good example, but this kind of repetition is just idiomatic or colloquial Pali. So you could just discard it and say it simply means being mindful of the body, but the commentary, of course, doesn't do that. It's got lots to say about it. Lots of interesting things. Nothing wacky or anything. Nothing like bodies in the middle of our bodies. It says something. Quite profound, I suppose, or quite important. And that is that, first of all, well, the first one is not that profound, but the first thing it says is that when you're mindful of the body, you're not being mindful of the feelings. So it's actually kind of an obvious statement here, but it's why the use of the idiom comes about, because when you're mindful of the body, you're not being mindful of the feelings. You're not being mindful of the mind, you're just being mindful of the body. So a way to translate this is, in regards to the body, he dwells being mindful of the body, of it just as being body. No, or he's mindful of the body. In regards to the body, he's mindful of that body. Which is still awkward in English, but you can get the idea of how that works quite easily in Pali. So, it means being specifically mindful of the body. But the commentary, the profound thing that the commentary says is that there is no body. the body doesn't exist. So in regards to the body, or in within that body, one sees what is real bodily phenomenon. So one isn't actually mindful of the whole body, one is mindful of a bodily phenomenon. I believe this is what the commentary is saying. But the point of course is very important in meditation, that we are indeed not mindful of the body, we're mindful of the experiences that arise that we call body. For instance, the rising of the stomach. When the stomach rises, that's a bodily phenomenon. When the body falls, when the rising falls, that's a bodily phenomenon. Even when you say to yourself, sitting, for example, when you're really mindful, you won't be aware of the whole body sitting, you'll be aware of a piece of the body, whatever piece is currently producing experience. You'll be aware of the feeling of the chair that you're sitting in, or the stiffness in the back, and so on. The question, can't you be both mindful of the body and of the feelings at the same time? I don't see how, really. I mean, it's this whole idea that the mind can take two objects at once. I don't see what that would mean, besides that there were two minds, which would really imply two people, I think. So if you're aware of something that is considered body, then you're just aware of that. But if you're aware of a feeling, then you're just aware of that. And another thing to maybe note here is that the Satipatthana Sutta is not really an Abhidhamma teaching. So it's going to gloss over, or it's going to just, is going to brush aside more technical explanations. Because a good example is actually, I believe, mindfulness is present in every wholesome consciousness, technically speaking. So you don't have to meditate to develop mindfulness. But the mindfulness that's being discussed in the sutta is actually much more than that. It's the development of many wholesome and fortified states of mind, morality, concentration, and wisdom. So questions like that, because it actually goes a lot deeper than that. The sutta doesn't get into, it doesn't mean it in that sense, because actually you're not mindful of anything, according to the Abhidhamma. You're mindful of something. You're not mindful of anything at that moment. You're mindful of what just occurred a single moment before. So first you have to see something, for example, and then there arises the mindfulness. And, well, maybe this is a good time to discuss what we mean by the word mindfulness. I don't think I did that last week, though. I can't remember. So when you feel like you are being mindful of more than one thing at the same time, is it an impression we get because our mindfulness shifts very quickly between them? Well, if you're really very, very mindful, you'll be able to see the difference. You'll be able to see the break from one to the next. It's a sign that for most people, the meditation is on a fairly superficial level. If you're doing an intensive meditation course, you'll be able to see quite clearly that the mind goes from one object to the other. So it's not that mindfulness is too quickly, it's that mindfulness is really not quick enough. When it feels that you're mindful of many things at once, it's a sign that your mindfulness is not yet strong, or your meditation practice is not yet strong. Which is common, as I said, it's not like that means you're a bad meditator. Most people who are practicing in daily life will not get that strong mindfulness, or will get it just for brief moments, and so their progress will be in fits and starts. Okay, but the word mindfulness, it doesn't really mean mindfulness, no. And this is important because we're going to get, after we explain this body and the body, we're going to get onto these three qualities of satipatthana, of the establishment of mindfulness. Let's just skip ahead, because body and the body, we finish up on that. No, what do we say? First, it can mean that we're just focusing on the body, and it can also mean that within the body, we are focusing on bodily phenomena. Not the body itself, but in that body, we're focusing on the body part, the body parts, or the body, the experiences that arise. And the same goes with feeling, consciousness, and dhammas. So, how does one do it? Ardent, clearly comprehending, and mindful. Atapi sampajano satima. And he puts these words it and of it in, which may or may not be necessary, because the point is the quality of the mind. It's not the point that he's trying to make here is that while you're already contemplating the body, but the quality of that contemplation has three aspects. First of all, it has a atapi, atapa, and it has sampajanya, and it has sati. So these three have to be explained in some detail, I think. Well, they have to each be explained individually. Ardent, atapi means, literally, I believe, means heat, to burn up, to get heated up. I believe it comes from the same root that the word temperature comes from. Tepid, maybe. It means one has to work, one has to be energetic. And it refers to the development of energy. It is said for the purpose of reminding us that this is work, that meditation, what we're really talking about here is a definition of meditation. And this is really important, because so often the word meditation is misunderstood. We think, we hear the word meditation, we think, oh yeah, sitting down and relaxing. Which is totally not what meditation is about. Meditation is not a form of relaxation. And the word meditation doesn't even mean that. It's just come to be given that kind of implication. Meditation is a contemplation. Meditation is associated with the word contemplation, or introspection, looking, learning, coming to a conclusion. And that's really what we're doing. It's as though we were sitting down to think about a problem that we had and come to a conclusion. But instead of it being a thought problem, it's a reality problem. So we have this reality problem of suffering, and we're sitting down to solve that problem, to come to an understanding of how to be free from the problem. And so to do that, we need to work. Meditation should be a work. So many people, for instance, the meditation that we teach here, we'll feel like it's uncomfortable. It's not relaxing, right? But you know, really, without getting into other explanations of why we have to do this noting, for example, the first thing we should say is that, well, meditation is hard work. Did you think enlightenment was going to be a walk in the park or easy? Did the Buddha ever say that it was going to be easy? Did the Buddha ever say that it should be easy? But the problem is we have all these almost enlightened beings coming to the Buddha and just poof, becoming enlightened, listening to one sermon or saying how happy it is to practice meditation. I mean, it is great happiness, but the key is it's great happiness to learn the truth. It's great happiness to realize you've been deluded your whole lives, your whole life, and now you found the truth. It's exciting. It's wonderful. It's stimulating. It's a great happiness to be free from all of the delusion, the greed, the anger. So. But that takes it takes a great amount of work, unless, you know, it takes a great amount of work for anyone who's got those qualities of mind to overcome them. The key is that some people don't have so much of them, and those people who met the Buddha and practiced with the Buddha were there for a reason. They had a great connection with the Buddha often, and were at the same level that he was, because they had worked, they had done the work. You know, if you think, for example, why Sariputta was able to become so brilliant in just 2 weeks. You know, and they say that 2 weeks was actually a long time, because Moggallana only took 1 week. But you think, well, 2 weeks to become the most wise, the wisest person in the world apart from the Buddha. It's not a long time. You think, well, let's see what I can get in 2 weeks. But it's not really like that. Because if you read the Jatakas, for example, you see, oh, Sariputta was working right alongside the Buddha, working really hard too. That's why he got the distinction from his hard work. So this should be a reminder to us that meditation is going to be hard work. And when we sit down to meditate, we should think that we're sitting down to work, not that we're sitting down to relax. Once you get good at it, it is really relaxing. And you know, even after a few days of doing intensive practice, or maybe a few weeks of doing daily practice, it really does get relaxing. And so this is one of the good results, but it gets that way from, you know, several days or weeks of work. And moreover, that's not the goal that we're looking for. It becomes relaxing, and that's nice, but that's not meditation. The relaxation is not meditation. It's a byproduct of the meditation. But it has nothing to do with the word meditation. It's nothing to do really with the Buddha's teaching. What did the Buddha want us to understand or practice in? But it's certainly a good beginning. You start practicing and you work really hard, and you will learn how to relax your mind. You'll find that when you learn how to be mindful, then you can slip back into it any time, and suddenly the stress leaves you. But the atapi is, first of all, the work that it takes to get there, and the work that you have to do even after you start to relax. Relaxation is really the development of the mind that is able to do work. The kammaniyang, I believe there's a word, kammaniyang, I can't remember what the word is. A mind that is able to do work, or fit to do work. I think it's coming when you can put to work. You have to be relaxed in order to do the work properly. But it is work, so that's the word ardent means. It means you have to put out work. With, of course, a note that it's not all about pushing yourself really, really hard, because we know that the Buddha spent 6 years pushing himself really, really hard and got nothing out of it. Actually, nothing. People think that 6 years was supposed to have given him something, and it took him 6 years to become enlightened, but actually it's not. According to the commentaries, it's not true. The Buddha took 6 years to realize that that the practice that he decided to undertake for 6 years was useless. And the reason is because he had done something very mean to a private Buddha, a Pacheka Buddha. I think I talked about this before. He said to a Pacheka Buddha that he was torturing himself, because he saw this Pacheka Buddha wearing rag robes and going on alms. And so he looked down and he disdained him. And because of that, it followed, that karma followed him on from life to life, and so he, when he wanted to become a Buddha, he had to torture himself. He had this wrong idea because he thought, oh, now I have to be, subconsciously he thought, I have to be like that person because of his bad karma, because of his bad deed and the way he set his mind. So it isn't all about working really hard, and this is clear in our understanding of what was meant by the word effort or energy in Buddhism. It's not pushing yourself. It's working, but it's working to balance your faculty, balancing your energy with concentration, working to train the mind, to straighten the mind. We're not trying to bend the mind into some strange shape. We're trying to unbend the mind. And that's a lot of work. But it won't come from pushing yourself. So some people practice meditation and constantly meditate, walking, sitting, trying to do so many hours or so. And they find that they actually get less results, or they become stressed more than someone who and maybe takes a break or practices on and off. And this is because effort, it means to not to push yourself, but it means to remove the defilements in the mind, greed, anger, delusion. When you have good, when you have bad qualities in your mind, it means to get rid of them. When you don't have the bad qualities in your mind, it means to keep them out. When you have good qualities in the mind, means to protect them. And when you don't have good qualities, it means to develop them. It refers to the effort taken to develop mindfulness. Well, what we mean by the word sati. So that's the word adhapi. The second word, sampajano, is often translated as it is here, clearly comprehending, but it's funny because looking at them, I want to switch the two. Switch the meanings. And actually, the meaning of sati should be clearly comprehending. And the meaning of sampajano should be mindful. It's not quite, but it's actually, in my mind, it's closer. And here's my rationale, my argument. The prefix sang, or sam in this case, because it's before a p, means full. It could mean right, but I would say here it means full. In context, it's pretty clear what's being talked about. Ba means also full or strong, and jhana comes from the root nya. In Pali it's nya, or in Sanskrit it's jhya. We have the verb janati, which means he knows or she knows. Knowledge. The jhana on the end means knowledge. It's the same as panya. Pajanya is the same as the word panya, the word for wisdom. And the O just means it's a male person that's being talked about. So, mindful maybe isn't the correct translation of sampajano, but full clearly fits the bill. And if we, what we mean by the word mindful, it means to be to know something fully, to have your mind have your awareness of something, be fully aware, which is is really what is meant by sampajano. Funny, huh? The word mindfulness should actually mean something, be the translation of sampajano. It's closer, anyway. But maybe we could translate it as full comprehension or right comprehension or right full awareness, I think, would be my preference. Something like full awareness or full consciousness, full knowledge, full and complete knowledge. That's what's meant by the word sampajanya. And sampajanya and sati actually go together. They complement each other, and the Buddha would often explain them together. Sampajano, I think, really requires sati, what we mean by the word sati, because sati is really the meditation practice. Sati is the effort that, or the action that one performs with effort in order to see the object clearly, in order to be fully aware of the object, in order to be mindful. So sampajanya is really the result of being mindful. It's this clear awareness of the object, the full awareness of the object. But it comes from developing what we mean by sati, which we could translate as what? Clearly comprehending. Well, maybe it is quite a stretch. The word sati doesn't mean clearly comprehending, but the meaning of it, the sense of it, is really very much that. To know something for what it is. Because the word sati really means remembrance or recollection. And you can see this quite clearly in things like the word Buddha anusati, mindfulness towards the Buddha. Anu is a prefix that means towards or in regards to or following. Buddha anusati, mindfulness of the Buddha. We always translate as mindfulness of the Buddha, but what does that mean? It's actually recollection. This is because the word sati comes from the root sar. And it's the same root that the word sarana comes from. So we translate sarana, buddhang saranang gacchami, as means I go to the Buddha for refuge. And sarana apparently can mean refuge. But etymologically, it means I go to the Buddha as my reference. Funny, I heard someone make a comment during a Dhamma talk that I take the Buddha as my reference. I'm like, what would Jesus do? What would Buddha do? As an example. I take Buddha as my guide. Buddhang saranang gacchami means I take the Buddha as my guide. I take the Buddha as my object of recollection, something that I will keep in mind whenever I do anything. Keep the Dhamma in mind, keep the Sangha in mind. So it means to keep something in mind, to remember something. And if you look in the commentaries or maybe even somewhere in the suttas, there's an explanation of what it means to be mindful. I'm leaning towards the idea that it's the commentaries, but it made me, when I heard it a long time ago, it made me laugh actually, because it's funny to think that mindfulness could mean this. You look at the word sati and it means to remember, so they say, how do you develop mindfulness? You develop it by remembering things, reciting texts and thinking about meanings of words, like translations, like what does this mean in this language, and this language, because then you get better memory. That's how you develop sati, the ability to remember things. What it is, it's quite clear what is meant in the Theravada tradition by the word sati. And it's not, I don't think, mindfulness. It's not this word mindfulness. So you'll often hear teachers, I think I heard Ajahn Sumedho, when he was giving a talk, I was there listening to him, and he mentioned the word mindfulness, that it's a very poor translation of the word sati. And I've heard other teachers say the same thing. The Abhidhamma says something quite interesting about the word sati, and that is that the root cause of satipatthana, or the that which is the cause of the condition for the arising of mindfulness, is something called tira sanya. So sannya we know to be this recognition of something. And so it shows that mindfulness or sati is clearly related to this ability to recognize something. But the word tira means strong or firm or fixed recognition. Tira sannya. So when you recognize something firmly, when you have a strong recognition of something, that's what gives rise to mind to sati. Now I hope this is an eye-opener for some people who maybe were wondering about this whole idea of noting. Where did this idea of noting come from? This mantra that I've come to call it. Where did it come from? I hope it should at least be a little bit clearer that it wasn't just someone's strange idea of how to do some esoteric type of meditation practice. It's actually putting into practice what is meant by the word sati or tira sanya. When you say to yourself, pain, pain, I'm sorry, that's all I can think right now because my foot has been cut open and I'm actually in great pain. Went to the doctors today and they cut my foot open, stuck scissors into it about an inch deep, looking for a piece of glass, and they came out and said, there's no glass there. And they said, are you sure? And they stuck it in again. And I was under anesthetic at the time, but it's worn off. And I was supposed to take some pills home, I think, but he didn't. So when you have pain, as I do right now, and spasms in the body and so on, tira sanya is when you say to yourself, pain. This is tira sanya. It creates this recognition of the object that is firm, that is established. So it's not ordinary sanya. Oh, that's pain. Yeah, my pain, my leg is in pain. Oh, what a terrible thing. It's firm recognition that sticks with mere recognition. It's so firm that you don't have room for anything else. That's what tira sanya means. And that gives rise to mindfulness. Gives rise to a state of mind that recognizes the object as it is. Recognizing the object as it is what gives rise to this clear awareness of the object as it is. See, it's almost the same thing, sati and sampajanya. Sati is the recognition of the object as it is. Sampajanya is the awareness of the object as it is. It's really referring to a single mind state, but giving you different qualities of that mind. You recognize it and therefore are clearly aware of it. And if it's great if you know how to break up these words and how to go back and find the etymological roots, because then it actually means something. Otherwise it's just a bunch of names for the same practice. Yeah, so people just gloss this over and they think, when you read this, it's funny how when you read this you'll skip right over it. You'll say, yes, ardent, clearly comprehending, and mindful. Okay, I get it. Yeah, we're practicing mindfulness. But when you go over them word by word by word, they actually take on a meaning. And this is how we teach this. You know, I would give a half-hour talk on these three words alone when I do a meditation course. Well, my teacher would do this. When he gives a talk, he would talk about, what does it mean to be mindful anyway? So that's another section of this paragraph. Next section is a bit difficult. We have this phrase vinaya loke abhijja do manasam, which is always translated as having overcome in this world, covetousness and grief. And it's funny that this translator can translate it this way when he's also translating the commentary in the same work. He put the commentary with it. And if you read his translation of the commentary, it's quite clear that meaning is not having overcome. But it's a bit difficult because vinaya. I mean, I'm not a Pali expert, but it seems to me to be a what we call a gerund or a past participle, having overcome, having gone beyond, having gone out from, having been led out from. But it's clearly not what it means, and or it has to be understood exactly, or else you'll misunderstand. And the way most of us misunderstand when we read this, we say, okay, yeah, so before you come to practice meditation, you have to give up covetousness and greed. It may very well be that the Buddha was saying this, that it was just a colloquial usage of the term, like stop worrying about your family kind of thing. Stop worrying about your work, stop worrying about, put these things aside for the time being, when you go into practice meditation. Put them aside. But you can't get by with that when you're talking to the commentators. They have to pull everything apart and tell you exactly where that fits in an Abhidhamma sense and so on. So it could just be colloquial. It could be that the Buddha is saying, having put aside the world for some time, you start practicing this way. But according to the commentary, and what it also very well could mean, because of the way the Pali is being used, it means as you're meditating, you're giving up the abhijja and domanas. You're giving up your desires and your aversions in the world. And see, so the thing that throws you off is the word world, because we think of the world as being, in regards to society and so on, but no, not according to the commentary, and also not according to the Buddha. The word world really refers to in this case, the five aggregates. There are three kinds of world. There's the world of space, I think I mentioned this already, the world of space, the world of beings, and the world of sankharas, the world of the five aggregates, formations. So the commentary says that actually the Buddha is talking about the body as being the world. So in regards to the body, he puts aside, as he practices, covetousness and grief. So as you can understand this, and the grammar supports it, that through the practice, at the same moment that one develops mindfulness, or in the moment that mindfulness arises, one has put aside covetousness and grief, or desire and aversion. Right? So the only way one can be in that moment clearly mindful is when at the same moment desire and aversion cease for that moment. But it doesn't have to mean, because in a technical sense, it's ridiculous to think that you could put away those first and then come and practice meditation, which is for the purpose of overcoming those. We just saw it up on top. Right? The commentary doesn't even think of the idea that you could have put them aside first. It doesn't even get that there's a grammatical, imprecision or there's this vagueness to it. Imprecision. It just says right away, yeah, having when you practice, you have overcome in that moment these two things. And the word overcome may be a little bit imprecise as well. It means, as I said, it means being led out or going out from, leaving behind. And I suppose covetousness and grief are good translations of abhijja and domanasa, but in a technical sense, it's just referring to greed and anger, or desire and aversion, the two opposites. This is what you put aside when you practice. You put aside all of the hindrances during the practice. So, for instance, when you have pain in your foot, if you don't practice, you start to get stressed and upset. But as soon as you say to yourself, pain, pain, all of that disappears and overcomes it. If you say to yourself, disliking, disliking, the same way. So any of the four foundations of mindfulness lead to this, lead you to put these aside and go leave them behind. So that's Kaya. Kaya should be understood as being the body. From the head to the feet, this is body. Everything that normally we understand to be us, this is body. The rest is actually totally mental, totally in the mind. It takes up no space, has no location. But the body is what takes up space. That's what we mean by body. The commentary gives a nice graphical definition of Gaia based on the word Aya, which is that which is the source, that which brings, or something like that, Aya. And Ka, it says, is short for what? Kuchi. Kuchitaro means, I don't remember. Kuchi means that which is disgusting. So it is the source of all sorts of disgusting things. But you know, I dig it. It's hard. Many people don't like this idea that the body is something disgusting. And we're going to get into disgusting parts of the body next, in one of the next sections. But it's really difficult to kind of understand the complaint that we have against this kind of definition. It says, kuchitanang ayoti kayo. It is the place of origin of disgusting and contemptible things, therefore it is the body, therefore it is Gaia. This is how the commentary makes up or creates an etymology for the word Gaia. Because really it is, I mean, the mind can be much more beautiful than the body, I think. It's hard to objectively see the body as a beautiful thing. And I've been called out for this as well, because actually it's true that in the end it's neither a disgusting or a beautiful thing whatsoever. But when we're dealing with concepts, the body in a conceptual sense and in a worldly sense, the body is everything that we consider to be disgusting. You know, urine and feces were just like walking toilets. Or portable toilets. That's all we are. We're full of, in the bottom there, squishing around this urine and feces. If you were to, you know, take any piece of your body, the most beautiful piece of your body, cut it off, and cut it up into pieces, you wouldn't find anything in there so beautiful at all. If you were to stop washing your body. Stop perfuming it. Let it be what it really is. You see in no short time that people don't want to be around you. So you have to go and live in the forest. Because your body starts to smell and get oily, and skin starts to flake off and so on. Builds up. So that's how the but you know, obviously that's not the root definition of, body. Body means, well, the parts of that which we understand in the physical to be our physical, the physical aspect of our being, from head to feet. Technically speaking, body, as I said, is just experiences. So we should be very careful not to get caught up in concepts and parts of the body. We're going to see two separate means of treating the body, separate treatments of the body in the Gayana Vasana. The first one is in terms of its conceptual parts, the hair, the fur, the nails, the teeth, the skin, the flesh, the bones, the tendons, and so on. And the other is in terms of the experiences of heat and cold and hardness and softness and motion and so on. And this is how we understand to be the difference of, between samatha and vipassana. When you take a concept as an object, like a part of the body as an object, and you think about that, how in this case how disgusting it is and so on, then you're practicing samatha meditation because the object is conceptual. When you focus on an experience, like the movements of the body or the sensations, hot, heat and cold, pressure and so on, then you're practicing vipassana, because you're practicing in regards to what is really there, what is really truly experienced. So, in an ultimate sense, body is just the four elements, earth, air, water, fire, that arise and cease in within an experience. His body. Vedana. Vedana is actually something different from the body. It's our experience of the body, or the feeling that comes as a result of the bodily experiences. So it could be a neutral feeling, or it could be a pleasant feeling, or it could be a painful feeling. Furthermore, it could be a painful bodily feeling, or a painful mental feeling, a pleasant bodily feeling, or a pleasant mental feeling. Based on the body, or based on the thought, or something. Or there is the experience of the upset in the body, which can be painful, and then there's the disliking of it, which is actually the experience of the pain of it as unpleasant. And then there's the bodily experience, which is soft or delicate, which is considered to be a pleasant bodily feeling, or a feeling of pleasure. And then there is the experience, or the appreciation of it, the feeling of it as being pleasant, and that's the mental thing. The word Vedana is interesting because it actually comes from the word Vid, which means to know. So Vedana is that which knows the object, which really tastes the object. And the commentary gives or the Abhidhamma, or I think the commentary explains this, that though many people prepare the food, it's the king that actually tastes the food. So Vedana is considered to be the king in this case. It's the one who actually tastes the food. There's the person who prepares it, the person who buys the food, gathers the food, the person who prepares it, the person who serves it, and then there's the king who actually gets to taste the food. And so Vedana is the taster. If it's good food, it's happy. If it's good food, happiness. If it's bad food, unhappiness. No one else knows. If no one else tastes it, then they don't feel unhappiness when there's bad food or happiness. So that's how we deny, because it's the one who knows what the experience is like. And everybody else has to ask, what's it like? The third is citta. Citta is translated here as consciousness, which the only complaint I have of using that word is that it's a lot bigger than the word citta. No? So we normally use the word mind because they're both four-letter words, citta and mind. Consciousness we reserve for the big word, vijnana. But it all means the same, really. It's just different names for the same phenomenon. As my teacher said, like this river and that river, the Mississippi River and the Ottawa River. I don't know if you know what the Ottawa River is. This river, that river. No? They have different names, but it's all water. It's the same water. So we have many names for this citta, vijnana, mano, hadaya. Names for the same phenomenon. Mind is that which knows the object, that which is conscious. So it might seem weird that we just said that vedana is the one that is aware of the object, but from the point of view, so we have to separate it. From the point of view of Satipatthana, actually, citta is referring, as we'll see, referring to the mental activity, the state of the mind, whether it is focused or unfocused, really the thought process. And vedana is referring to the feelings, the sensations. But in the Abhidhamma, citta contains vedana. So in reality, vedana is a part of the mind. Every citta contains vedana. Vedana is one of those cetasika, that those mental factors that is present in every single consciousness. Oftentimes just a neutral feeling, but there's always a feeling. So a little bit confusing, but this is why an example of how important it is to understand the difference between a sutta exposition, which is generally conceptual, and a Abhidhamma definition or exposition, which is much more precise. And they complement each other, and we can explain them like this, and explain the difference, explain the similarity, explain how they relate to each other. But here it's much more practical, and so there's a lot of concepts and conceptual categorizations. We don't even, as I said, have the five aggregates. We've instead got four things, which are a substitute for the five aggregates. This is basically because they're much more practical this way. The fourth one is called Dhamma, and it's invariably translated as the word mind objects, and that's because in another context, Dhamma does mean that which the mind takes as an object. But you gotta admit, it's a bit ridiculous to use the word mind objects, or mental objects, as he uses here, sorry, as one of these four categories, because well, on the face of it, anything can be a mind object. No? It could be, the body could be an object of the mind, of the mind. Vedana could certainly be an object of the mind. But from the, I believe from the Abhidhamma point of view, the word Dhamma in that context of a mental object refers to a thought. An object that is wholly mental, that has nothing to do with the body. And that also doesn't work either, because then we have the five aggregates are a part of Dhamma. I think we're much better off understanding the word Dhamma as being the teachings of the Buddha. Because what you see about Dhamma is that it is very specific teachings. And it looks like these are teachings that have been picked out specifically because of their importance as place markers, or you know, like being picked out of a whole basket of virtues or of qualities or of teachings, as being the practical and important ones, and it's really neat if you look at it and if you put them into practice, how they go in order and how you begin to appreciate one and then the other, and how you put into practice first one and then the other. Like in the beginning, you don't see anything because you're just being mind. You have so many hindrances. So the first dhammas are the hindrances. The second, and then you start to settle down and you start to see the difference between concepts and reality, and so you start to see the five aggregates. And that's, I believe, the second group. Let's get these out of order. Let's make sure here. Yeah, the aggregates. And after the aggregates, then you have the sense bases, and you can say which one comes first, I guess. You could argue that after seeing the aggregates, then you start to see where the aggregates are arising. The aggregates are arising based on the six senses. From a theoretical point of view, it's good to know that. And it's good so that then when you practice, you'll be able to discern this and break the experience down quite clearly. And once you put all of that together, then you start to develop the seven factors of enlightenment. And by understanding these, you get on the path and you start to develop the factors of enlightenment. Once you develop the factors of enlightenment, you realize the Four Noble Truths. They don't have to be an ordered list. They could be in that way, but you can see how all of them are, if you think about it, if you look at them, if you study them, and you really listen to how the Buddha tells us to practice according to them, you can see how they're really the most fundamentally practical teachings of the Buddha. So these are dhammas, these are the various teachings of the Buddha. Another one that people prefer sometimes is reality. You know, dhamma means that which is real. So these are the realities. But the problem that I have is that these aren't the only realities, or these aren't all the ways of explaining reality. And they seem to be fairly arbitrary if it's talking about reality. Why would you start with the five hindrances if you're talking about reality? It doesn't seem reasonable. And since this is a teaching text, practical text, it seems much more reasonable to understand it as the teachings. So that's how I do it. And so there we have the four foundations of mindfulness. We've completed another paragraph. And I'm going to stop there tonight, because I have some Vedana Nupasana to do this evening. And it's funny, you don't realize until you get into this position how it doesn't have to be uncomfortable, but it really takes your mind away. When you have so much pain, it is difficult to focus on anything else, which is why even good meditators would find themselves unable to attain states of peace and bliss and so on when they had great pain. So there were people, monks in the Buddhist time, who tried to kill themselves because they felt that they couldn't attain the jhanas, for example. It really takes away from your focus when you have a physical impairment. So I'm going to stop it for that, and hopefully by next week the hole in my foot will have closed up, and the pain will have gone away, I'm sure. And thank everyone for coming tonight. Apologize for the slow pace, but I think it's a good pace, actually. We're really getting some important points down. So that's all for tonight. Thanks for tuning in. And if you have questions, I'm happy to take them. But first of all, let's let everyone go. We'll do the closing homage. So we scroll back up to the top and start with the Arahant. Arahant Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Adivadi. Svākhāto bhagavata dhammo dhammaṁ namasāṁ Supatipanno bhagavato sāvaka saṅgho saṅghaṁ namāṁ. Okay, that ends our session for tonight. If you have questions, I'm happy to take them. Otherwise, have a good night.